Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. We all like to get paid, and we joke about being poor. Someone has said, one advantage of being poor is that it doesn't cost much. Another meme says, maybe it's appropriate that "In God We Trust" is inscribed on a dollar we can't. When my daughter was young, I tried to teach her the value of money by giving her quarters to pay for the little jobs she could do. One day, her grampy pulled out some change to give her and then said, "No, let's find some decent money." So he gave her a dollar bill. From that time on, she would always ask for decent money. If you looked at the title of this sermon, Warnings for the Wealthy, you might think, well, that doesn't apply to me. I'm not wealthy. My friends, you may be surprised. You may need this sermon because you are not wealthy. Are you ever angry because the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? Does it bother you when some wealthy person avoids paying income taxes while the rest of us pay all the time? Are you irritated when white-collar criminals get off with a legal slap on the wrist while some poor man ends up in jail for a far lesser crime? If you ever feel the sting of economic injustice, then James is writing to you. The first six verses of James chapter 5 are what literary analysts call an apostrophe. I do not mean that little punctuation mark that appears before an S at the end of a word. An apostrophe, in literary circles, is a rhetorical device that a writer uses to address someone not present. So James is addressing wealthy non-Christians who are not present, while actually writing to poor Christians. Earlier in James chapter 1, he had addressed wealthy Christians and he called them brothers, so we know they were Christians. And some wealthy people are fine believers. However, here he does not address these wealthy people as brothers. Furthermore, James does address a different group of people as brothers beginning in verse 7. James does not call for the rich people to repent in these verses. Instead, he calls for these rich people to weep and wail because of the coming judgment of God. For all these reasons, we know he is addressing wealthy non-Christians in this passage who are oppressing and exploiting the poor people in society. Economic justice is important because economic injustice is horribly real, and we need to know that God will judge injustice in his time. James' point is that warnings for the wealthy encourage the needy. And he raises four warnings in this paragraph, which are intended to encourage the poor, oppressed Christians to whom he is writing. Warning number one, the warning against hoarding encourages the needy. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 3. The warning against hoarding encourages the needy. Listen to God's words to us in James 5. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you, and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in these last days that you have stored up for your treasure. Remember, James is talking about non-Christians and economic injustice in these verses. We will never understand these verses if we don't understand the historical and cultural context. The first century world can be described economically in three words. Fewer have more. Fewer have more. The Mediterranean world was exemplified by the grand estates or villas located in various parts of the empire. Each villa would have an owner who controlled the lives of literally hundreds of families and thousands of acres of land. Rich people would buy up cheap land from poor people and develop a villa in an area. Laborers would flock to the area for work. Villages would spring up where this wealthy land baron became a virtual dictator. One landowner, named Eliezer ben Harsum, a Jewish landlord, is said to have inherited from his father 1,000 villages and 1,000 ships and so many slaves that they did not know their own master. These land barons became incredibly wealthy and lived in luxury while exploiting the poor and abusing their slaves. The picture James gives us is of landowners with great wealth, which they waste on themselves. And James mentions three specific forms of wealth in these verses. First, he mentions food or grain. James says that your riches have rotted. His point is that you can have all the grain you want stored in your granaries, but sooner or later it will rot. Your wealth becomes useless. Second, we have clothes. James says your garments have become moth-eaten. We can accumulate vast amounts of clothing, but sooner or later they get destroyed. What good is a Gucci or a Louis Vuitton outfit if you die that afternoon? What good is a closet full of designer shoes after a flood? Third is money. James says your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you in the coming judgment. Strictly speaking, of course, gold does not rust. But the Romans controlled their economy by mixing gold with other metals to form an alloy from which they made all of their coins. These coins would rust because of the other metallic content. The point is that you can hoard all the money you want, but ultimately, wasted resources testify against you in the day of judgment, when God is going to judge his world. God tells us to use it or lose it. Wealth is to be used, not hoarded. Hoarders will lose it all in the last days when they stand before God in judgment. James says that wealth will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Everyone is storing up treasure for eternity right now in this life, every one of us. We are either storing up treasure that will be burned up in judgment or storing up treasure that will last in eternity. The principle of Scripture is that we must use the resources that God gives to us for things that have eternal value. You say, well, Dave, is it sinful to save? No. There is a difference between saving and hoarding. The difference between saving and hoarding is a matter of quantity. It is a matter of usability. Saving becomes hoarding when my wealth exceeds my foreseeable needs. Saving becomes hoarding when my resources are wasted in the selfish quest for more and more. Saving becomes hoarding when I refuse to use my wealth for God's work. There is, of course, an ambiguous and subjective line between saving and hoarding. It's a judgment call for each and every one of us. I cannot draw an objective line between the two. What we can say from this passage is that hoarders will reap God's judgment one day. Don't hoard your money. There are needy people out there that God cares about, so the warning against hoarding encourages the needy. And secondly, the warning against stealing encourages the needy in verse 4. James is warning them about stealing money and resources. James says in verse 4, "Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth." Once again, we must understand this passage in its historical context. Wealthy landowners drove small farmers out of business with their pricing practices. And then what they would do is they would purchase the lands of these poor farmers that they've driven out of business. They would purchase their lands for a fraction of the value. These farmers would then go to work for the wealthy landowner. They had no other choice. However, the landowner withheld wages from their workers, perhaps on the pretext of legal technicalities, so that the wealthy owner could profit from the unpaid wages. Old Testament law clearly stipulated that a day laborer be paid on the day he worked, because he needed that daily income to live. God said in Deuteronomy 24, verses 14 and 15, "You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your countrymen or one of your aliens, your immigrants, who is in your land, in your towns. You shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets, for he is poor and sets his heart on it, so that he will not cry out against you to the Lord, and it becomes sin in you." The withholding of wages was one of the four sins which were said to cry out to heaven in the Old Testament. God cares about economic injustice. Now, there were no unions to protect the laborers in the ancient world, who were virtually slaves in many cases. This was particularly true when the land baron owned the villages and controlled the legal system in the region. Years ago, Clarence Larkin Jr., a professor at Columbia Graduate School, presented an article on the ethics of inflation from a Christian perspective. Larkin argued that inflation robs the poor to pay the rich because the rich control the flow of money. The rich can use inflation to make money for themselves by investing in things that inflate in value, whereas inflation eats away at the buying power of the poor people. For example, in 1972, the median household income in the United States was $9,000. We would have to make $65,000 to have the same value in 2023. If we look at home prices, we can see how inflation robs the poor. The median price of a home in 1972 was $26,800, when the median household income was $9,000. But in 2022, the median price nationwide was $444,300. And many markets, of course, are even higher. Housing prices have exploded in recent years, making real estate investment attractive to the wealthy. So wealthy people buy up property as an investment. This drives up demand for fewer properties, radically inflating the price of houses. Buyers in high inflation times often end up offering more than the asking price for a house, and those with less income can't compete in that market, leading to greater homelessness among the poor. The difference between the rich and the poor grows bigger as the rich make money on their investments. We see this inflation phenomenon in third world countries where the inflation rates skyrocket. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. This reality spawned a movement known as liberation theology, which is essentially Marxism in the guise of Christianity. Liberation theology calls for Christians to revolt and overthrow the rich and take back the money they are stealing from the poor. Well, the people that James is writing to in this letter felt the same pressure. But James says that it is not the way of Christianity to overthrow the wealthy by force. That's not God's way. We are to be patient and wait for God to deal with the economic injustices that we see in our world. Now, don't get me wrong. This does not mean that we should not speak out against economic injustice, as James is doing here, or do what we can to combat economic injustice. But we need ultimately to trust in God to judge such injustices in our time as well, and in his time, most importantly. When God is ready to judge economic injustice, he will do so. James says that the outcry of the oppressed reaches the ears of Lord Sabaoth. Lord Sabaoth is the Old Testament name for the Lord of armies, who comes in judgment of those who are exploiting others. We are to be patient for that day of judgment to come, James says in verse 7. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. So James' warnings against the rich for stealing are intended to encourage the needy that the wealthy will get their judgment from God eventually. Now we come to the third warning in this passage. The warning against indulging encourages the needy. The warning against indulging, verse 5. Look at verse 5. You have lived luxuriously. You have indulged, in other words. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. So James levels two charges in this verse against the self-indulgence of so many rich people. The rich live in luxury. James could clearly see this in his day, and of course we can see it in our day. The rich pursued pleasure. They wasted their money on their luxuries. the sprawling villas of their day, like the huge mansions of our day, were excessively opulent. The high priestly family of Israel was well known for their wealth and their luxury. They were paid a large salary from the temple treasury, so they were living off the gifts of their people. For example, Miriam, the daughter of one wealthy priest, was given a dowry of 1 million gold denarii, of which 10% was allocated just for perfumes and jewelry, including a false tooth fastened by gold and silver wire. After her husband died, Miriam cursed the scribes because they would only allow her 400 gold denarii a day for luxuries. Martha was another lady of the high priestly family. The law required that everyone attend the ceremonies on the Day of Atonement barefoot. She was so pampered that she carpeted the whole distance from her house to the temple gate because she wanted to see her husband, Joshua, son of Gamaliel, officiate at the ceremony in the temple. So, the first charge from James is that the rich live in luxury. The second charge is that the rich fatten their hearts in the day of slaughter. The imagery is drawn from Jeremiah 12:3, where the prophet Jeremiah is praying. Jeremiah asks God to judge the wicked who are prospering through their unjust actions against the poor people. How long will the wicked prosper is Jeremiah's request. James picks up that theme and says that the wealthy are like oxen getting fat in their self-indulgence without realizing that they were being fattened up for slaughter on the day of God's wrath. There is coming a day when all this self-indulgent living will come to an end. It is the day of God's wrath. In God's time, He deals with sin. He deals with economic injustice. He deals with oppression and exploitation. And we must wait upon the Lord for that time. Oh, how we need these warnings today. Self-indulgent behavior is everywhere in our world today. People use money to feed their appetites. The rich and powerful exploit the marketplace to get what they want. Warnings against self-indulgence encourage the needy with the knowledge that God will not let economic injustice last forever. He will one day judge the self-indulgent hedonists of our day, too. That leads to James' fourth and final warning in verse 6. The warning against killing encourages the needy. The warning against killing. James writes in verse 6 to these wealthy oppressors, You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. The word condemned referred to a judicial sentence. Once again, we must understand the verse in its historical context. These rich, self-indulgent land barons controlled the courts, too. They had the legal system in their wallets, so to speak. White-collar criminals often get away with their crimes because they have the financial clout to use the courts for their goals. Government judges in first century Palestine came around to the villages very infrequently. There were often delays, long delays, which dragged out any legal case, and legal cases were very expensive. For all of these reasons, the wealthy land barons controlled the courts for their goals. The poor couldn't do anything about it. James tells us that the wealthy land barons condemned and even had people executed in their regions. They actually had people killed. There was little resistance by the righteous. The poor righteous person was incapable of resistance because he did not have any resources to resist the power and wealth of the landowner working in the courts. The righteous man, here in this verse, is a generic term for all righteous people. I don't believe that James is talking about Jesus in this verse. Furthermore, James was not predicting his own death here, although James became an excellent illustration of this accusation in just a dozen years. James became known in Jerusalem as James the Just, which is the exact term he used here. He became known, in other words, as James the Righteous One. He was highly respected, not only among Christians, but among Jews, for his prayer life. Church tradition says that he prayed so long that his knees became as hard as camel's knees. Well, James was executed, he was killed, by the high priest Annas the Younger in 62 AD because of his teaching that Jesus was the Messiah. Josephus tells us that James was stoned to death by the Sanhedrin. The killing was not popular even with the Jewish population of the day because James was considered a righteous man, even by the Jewish people. There was even a popular belief among many Jews that God allowed the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans under Vespasian, which took place 8 years later, because of the killing of James. God says, "There is coming a day when the rich and powerful will pay for the deaths of men like James." The destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD was that day for many of the wealthy high priestly family. The land barons were wiped out by the Roman armies. Their wealth and estates were taken by the invading army. God tells us that there will be a payday someday. Payday Someday was the title of one of the most famous sermons in American history. The sermon was preached for the first time in 1919 by a Southern Baptist pastor named Robert G. Lee. The sermon takes an hour and 15 minutes and was repeated so many times that some people actually heard it for the 22nd time. Yet audiences around the United States kept requesting that Robert G. Lee preach it again. It's a powerful expression of the principle that God deals with the unjust oppressor in his time. And James would say, "Warnings for the wealthy encourage the needy." Payday, Someday, is the exposition of the story of Naboth and his little vineyard in 1 Kings 21. Naboth was a poor man who had a little plot of land next to the lands of King Ahab's summer palace in the valley of Jezreel. Ahab wanted that little piece of land for a vegetable garden, and he offered to pay Naboth for his land. Ahab even offered a fair price. But Naboth refused, saying that the land had been in his family for generations, and he could not give it up. Well, King Ahab was enraged. He was so enraged that he went back to his palace, and he refused to eat any supper. He threw a temper tantrum. Ahab went to his room, lay down on his bed, and pouted. There was the mighty king, blubbering to the wall. His wife, Queen Jezebel, comes to see him and says, basically, "Look, you big baby, you're the king of Israel. You can have whatever you want. Just leave it to me. I will get that land for you. Jezebel brings Naboth before the courts on false charges. Then she plants two false witnesses to say that Naboth cursed God and the king, whereupon the soldiers take Naboth out and stone him to death. Ahab gets his precious vegetable garden. The fiery prophet Elijah enters the story. He goes to meet Ahab one day while Ahab is proudly inspecting his new property. Elijah, the Tishbite, points his long, bony finger at Ahab and says, "In the place where the dogs lick the blood of Naboth, the dogs shall lick your blood as well. And as for Jezebel, the dogs shall eat her flesh in the courtyard of the palace." It would be 3 long years later that Ahab was killed in battle, and his blood ran down into his chariot. As the men were washing out the blood from his chariot, the dogs gathered around to lick Ahab's blood. 16 long years passed after the time of Naboth's death, until God's justice was done to Jezebel. Elijah was long gone by this time as well. Joram, the son of Ahab, reigned on the throne. Jehu, the avenger, rode his chariot to meet Joram on the very property of Naboth and killed him where Naboth once lived. Jehu raced to the city where Jezebel is waiting with her painted face and all decked out in her finest clothes. She looked out the upstairs window of the palace as Jehu entered the gate. And some servants pushed her out of the window, and she fell to her death on the stone below. Jehu rode over her with his chariot to make sure that she was dead. And then Jehu goes into the palace to eat some supper. When he sends the men out to bury her body, they find nothing but her skull, her feet, and her hands. The dogs had eaten everything else, just like Elijah had predicted 16 years earlier. It's a gory story for sure. Yet both Ahab and Jezebel deserved their gruesome deaths for their horrible murder of the innocent Naboth. Someone has said, "The wheels of justice grind slowly, but grind exceedingly small." God judges injustice in his time. And that, my friends, should encourage all of us as we watch the wicked prosper and wonder when God will right their wrongs. There will be a payday someday.